Good evening. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain and Bella Vista. And this is Jim Dowling, host of Write Stuff. And on Write Stuff, I interview local writers. And tonight I have a very special guest, Myra Buteau. She's written a book called Kennet, The Town Under Shasta Lake. Thank you for coming in, Myra.
Well, thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I checked it out of the library a couple days ago, and I really enjoyed it. It was very informative. You did a wonderful job of telling the story of Kennet and mixing it in with illustrations that really give you an idea what the times were like. So let's start from the very beginning. I understand it was a Wintu village.
Yes.
And why did it grow? What brought the first settlers to the area?
Well, first it was a Wintu Native American village. Then in the 1850s, a group of Germans discovered gold, and it was named Backbone. And finally, in the 1870s, when the railroad arrived, it was called Kennet. And it was just a fascinating place because at that time, people traveled across the rivers, around, you know, along the rivers, and that was happened to be along the Sacramento River. And so Kennet, once people started settling there, they discovered copper. And as many of the boom and bust cycles that happened in Shasta County in the area at the time, Kennet was no exception. Kennet was populated first by people who came to build the railroad. Mm-hmm. And then they built hotels and taverns and boarding houses. And then once they discovered copper, that's when people came from all over to mine the copper. And a lot of copper was taken out of that area. The area, if you follow the Sacramento River for about 20 miles from like Redding, and then you turn along the Pitt River for about 10 miles, it becomes a copper crescent. And geologically, when the area was formed, they're theorizing 350 to 400 million years ago, there was hydrothermal like springs that formed the mineral deposits in that area, and that became the Copper Crescent. And on one side of the Sacramento River, there's more copper than on the other side of the Sacramento River, and it's just how the area formed. And so it was a fascinating story of people who came from all over, and it was a whole different era. Yeah. It was, you know, after people came and mined the area, first for gold and then for copper, they really attracted groups of people that were seeking employment. And it was just a very fascinating era and area live in at that time.
Well, I can see the old Iron Mountain mine area from my front door. So that was one of the first major operations, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was, because there was a Gossan, and they saw the oxidized iron ore, and there was a surveyor that came through, and he recognized that because he had a geological background. And yeah, that was the first mine that went in. But people were putting claims in the late 1890s. I mean, there was like claims being put out there for like every day. There were claims because people just were, you know, there was so much minerals. There were so many minerals in the area at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And wasn't the first really successful owner of Iron Mountain from England?
Yes, yes. And they brought people from England to work in the mines. Yeah. I mean, they even brought an Earl. The Earl of Renwick came. Yeah. But they had such a caste system, yes, which I thought was very interesting, mm-hmm, that, you know, they painted the houses, you know, white for the upper management and the people that, you know, the engineers and such, and then they painted the houses red for just like the common folks. So you could visually identify who was who. And status was important in those days, too. And the different classes didn't mix. Different classes of people didn't mix. So it was very interesting.
It is interesting, you know, and they brought a lot of sports. Cricket was introduced.
And, fox hunting.
Fox hunting.
Yes, I mean, of all things to bring to that area.
Well, you know, I don't know. This is a little side note, but I've been hiking around these hills for a long time, Old Shasta area, and I find a lot of pottery from England out there. It's labeled English.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Over the years, quite a bit of stuff. Maybe it has something to do with that period of time.
It probably did. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So, fascinating history. A lot of boom and bust having to do with copper prices.
Yes, and that really drove the boom and bust cycles too. So as Kennet, which got its name first, it was spelled with one T, K-E-N-N-E-T, and it was named after a squire from the railroad era. But then once it became established, they spelled it with two T's at the end, K-E-N-N-E-T-T. So if you go to look for archival historical photos, like in Kalispheer, for example, if you put in Kennet with one T, you get a different set of images than you put...
Really?
Yes, than if you put Kennet in with two T's, and you get a whole different set of images. And if you put in different words, too, like Iron Mountain Mine, I finally put that as a phrase in, and up pops the Iron Mountain Mine, a photo of it, of their facility from back then. It's very fascinating to me to look for the images, because in this book, I use a lot of images, and it is to help tell the story. It's like that a picture is worth a thousand words, and it really is, because it gives you the feel and the essence and what did these people look like and what
I agree. You did a great job with that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And what did the town look like and how did they dress back then, and how did they make a living? I mean, that was well before any kind of social systems existed to help. You know, if you didn't work, you didn't eat. That was kind of how it was back then. So you saw people that were very hardworking.
Sure. Well, somewhere in the book you mentioned that it was a pretty well-paying job at one time compared to other jobs.
Yes. Yes, it was. But they needed the manpower. Like, unlike panning for gold, where you need a pan, copper mining just took so much more infrastructure and so many more processes than a gold mining operation did. So they really had to have companies come in and invest money in the infrastructure in order to process that copper, because it just took a lot of processing to get it to that purer state where they could then ship it to its destination.
Yeah, and they took out a lot of copper.
They did.
By today's standards, they would have made many millions of dollars, right? Those mines.
One mine in particular, it generated $815,000 at the time. Well, today that's worth $28 million.
Yeah.
So yes, money was just pouring out of that area. But then part of the challenge with it is that in the processing of copper, for example, the roaster workers' hair and whiskers turned green because it just had so much environmental damage that was done to the area because of the fumes from the smelters. So then at one point, the areas around first Keswick and then Kennet became denuded.
Absolutely.
There was no vegetation left. But people at first were okay with it. They were like, well, this is where the money's coming from, so we'll kind of, you know, not really care, not say anything. But then as the fumes drifted towards Anderson and Happy Valley, where there was a great agriculture there in the fruit trees and the vegetables, then it started killing off the crops. That is when these farmers decided to hire attorneys, and that was what launched what was called the Farmer Smelter Wars. And that was the war really between the lawsuits between the farmers and the mine owners. But then ironically, the mine owners would pay those people for their land. You know, and it was just like, oh, isn't that an interesting concept? Isn't that an interesting way to do business, you know? And but then it kept getting worse and worse, and finally they were able to get injunctions to shut down
federal
these smelters.
Injunctions.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So that
hired some big name lawyers.
They did. They hired very powerful lawyers, and they really had the case just by showing the photographs of the before and the after.
I've seen those photographs. I mean, you talk about denuded. It looks like the moon. There isn't anything growing.
Yes.
And the erosion must have been terrible.
Yes, yes, it was. Yeah. So, yeah, that was just a real big problem that led to, but not before, though. When World War I broke out, the price of copper soared.
Sure.
Because they needed it for bullets, ammunition, gun parts, and that type of thing. But then when the World War I ended, the copper prices plummeted. And that's when you begin to see the beginning of the end of Kennett and those other copper mining towns. So
the population started to go down?
Yes, because the mines started closing. And there was no work, and these people had to go other places to find work. So that led to the population just dwindling of these areas, including Kennett. Which, okay, the one thing I thought was very interesting was the Diamond Bar in Kennett, where they ran three shifts of eight men, 24 hours a day. They had a bar. They had a bottling room. They brought alcohol in by the train car loads into their facility where they bottled the liquor and then they sold it. He had a restaurant. And this Diamond Bar too had a 50-foot long mahogany bar that was just gorgeous, and ornate light fixtures and paintings of ladies scantily clad.
Yeah.
On the walls and on the ceilings, and he just did a
phenomenal. It was a real boom town
at the
time. Yes. There was a lot of partying going on, apparently.
Yes.
You know, miners probably coming in, want to have a good time.
Yes.
I guess. That is fascinating. And today it's down there. Do you think there's much of the town down there underwater?
Well, they only moved a few of the buildings. And some of the buildings, they burned down. But it's unfortunate that they didn't try to remove more of the artifacts before they flooded that area. Because just the historical... And then because it's down 400 feet underwater behind Shasta Dam, it's too far down for recreational divers to go down there to check it out, to see, if they could find something down there. Wouldn't that be fascinating to go?
It would be. Take a little submersible down there and see what's still there.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. Well, it's an incredible story. There were some interesting folks who were involved in that. I know the Balmas, who later went on to be notable here in Redding.
Yes.
But they started off in Kennett, apparently.
With the City Hotel, yes, they did. And so that was and then also in the founding of the town was the Golinski family and also the Butters family. Well, there was a rivalry going on between those two. And I've come across in research books, they'll say Golinski was the father of Kennett, and then they'll say Butters was the father of Kennett. So it was like this kind of like a feud sort of.
Well, they were competing, and they had different visions, didn't they, of what Kennett should be?
Yes, and Butters wanted it to be an affluent city, whereas Golinski didn't want it to be an affluent, and they both sold lots, and they both sold their lots for different amounts of money, and they described them, you know, as being like Butters as being in the, you know, the cleaner part with cleaner air Kennett, and the more affluent, and his lots were like $50 a lot, and Golinski's were only $35 a lot. So I couldn't imagine buying a piece of property for only $35 or only $50.
I noticed in one of the ads, and I can't remember if it was from one of those two, but something about no Chinese being involved.
Yes. Now that was a very, it was a very, sometimes parts of history are difficult to talk about.
Sure. And
because they touch on very sensitive topics that are not easy to discuss. And in a newspaper clipping, it talked about there were no Chinese items among its wares. It had the white labor stamp adorned them all. But back then, in the 1880s, there were laws in place that essentially discriminated against the Chinese, not allowing them to immigrate into the United States. And there very much was a caste system and a divide of the different ethnic individuals. Sure. Of the town. And so it's sad to see things like that, but it, when you see it in history and you understand the era in which that occurred and the laws that were in place and the mindset at the time,
right,
you know, it kind of, I hope it gives people a better perspective of what it was like, so you can maybe have more empathy for different people and for a different time, and and it's very difficult in some of these situations.
I mean that's one of the fascinating things about history. You can try to look at it in the context of the times, or you can look at it through our lens today, and you miss a lot if you can't try to get back to the perspective of people when it was happening.
Yes.
But so, Myra, how large did Kennett eventually get to be?
When it incorporated, there were 3,000 people in Kennett.
And most of them employed by the mines?
Yes, and Mammoth Mine, that was right next door to Kennett. They even had a walking bridge for the employees to just cross over so that they could work there.
Wow, pretty well-developed town. The smelters, now, that was very expensive. It was very elaborate and took a lot of capital to keep the smelters going. How does that process work?
Well, when they, I think it's interesting that one of the smelters, it took 1 million bricks. They ordered 1 million bricks from the Holt and Gregg quarry to build what they dubbed as a $1 million smelter. But in reality, it took $2 million to build. And its smokestack was 250 feet tall. And it was the operation itself where you had to blow oxygen into the copper to create a copper mat. It was just, you see big vats, huge vats of liquid as they're increasing the heat for the smelter to burn off all the other chemicals and such and minerals that were in. So there was zinc released and gold released and silver released, all just to bring it down to get it to that copper mat so that they could turn it into ingots.
Sure.
of copper to ship.
And this is what the roaster was?
The roaster roasted it. It was a whole process. First it was roasted, then it was smelted, then the chemicals were added, then the oxygen was blown into it.
Yeah.
It was just such a very elaborate operation to get to the final copper that was 98% to 99% pure.
Wow. So they built these huge stacks, big smokestacks, 150 to 250?
Yes, 250 feet
tall.
That's
pretty darn tall.
Yes. But then when the farmer smelter wars were going on, as part of an accommodation, they required these smelter and mine owners to put bag houses. Well, the bag houses to capture this the fumes, they were bigger than the smelters themselves. But they would catch, you know, the gold particles, and it helped for a while, but it really didn't in the end. The damage had already been done.
Yeah. So the bag house was probably part of a legal settlement.
They had
to stay in operation.
Yes.
They had to try to capture that stuff.
Yes.
But by then, the land was pretty denuded.
Yeah, it was. And the damage had already been done, and the injunctions to close these smelters had already gone through. So in Coram, for example, they blew and there's a picture of it too. It's very cool. Where they blew it up, and it's just like, wow. Like today, you couldn't just like blow up a big old stack, and you see the smoke all kind of around. Well,
that's an interesting philosophy. If you've got this toxic stuff, just build a higher stack and hope that it'll blow away.
Yes, and that's what they
tried
to do.
Somebody else's backyard.
Yeah, exactly, but it didn't work. So, and even I found that this was interesting. I presented my documentary, which is a historical documentary, and then I write a book. But when I presented the historical documentary to Leadership Reading, one of the women that was there had worked for the Forest Service, and she made note that the forest never did recover. And so I thought that that was really interesting, mm-hmm. that even though they stopped the operation.
Did she have an explanation for that? A lack of topsoil or toxicity of the ground?
Toxicity of the ground. Yeah. It was still toxic because what would you do? You would have to remove all the dirt. You would have to go down X amount of... But then they didn't have to worry about that because they were going to build the Shasta Dam, which at first was called the Kennett Dam, and then they had the name changed.
Really?
Yes,
the
I know.
Kennett Dam.
Yeah, the Kennett Dam, because it was built right where Kennett, it was going to put it underwater.
Yeah,
it was
going to. So is Kennett really close to the dam?
Yes, where the face of the dam is, where the concrete curved structure is, it's about a mile or on a mile and a half back from there, but it's impounded under 400 feet of water.
Yeah.
So they built that dam for flood control, hydroelectric power, and irrigation.
In 1938, was it?
Yes, that's when they started. But, you know, the Great Depression had hit,
sure.
and there were so many people out of work. And so they came to this almost boomtown area again.
Mm-hmm.
It became another boomtown area so that these dam workers could help build the dam. And it was, but in the mines, see, they didn't close any of the mines. They didn't block off the mines. They just built the dam and let the water, because we have such a high amount of rainfall in that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And it just flooded the mines. Well, nobody did anything environmentally to those mines before that happened. So I thought that was very interesting too. That
we know that Iron Mountain is a Superfund site.
Yes, it is.
And I live what would have been downstream or wind, you know, probably. Well, I looked at my property and the properties around and wondered what they would have looked like before, you know, before the big mining operations.
Oh, wow.
I know it burned off a lot, but I'm just thinking it must have looked quite a bit more verdant at one time.
Yes. Yes. But, probably. Yeah.
Oh, my guest tonight is Myra Buteau, and we're talking about her book, Kennett, The Town Under Shasta Lake. And I was going to ask you, Myra, what drew you to this project?
Well, ironically, I did a historical documentary called Gold Fever, The True Story of California's Gold Rush from 1848 to 1855. And I presented it to a group that I belonged to at the time called the Shasta Miners and Prospectors Association. And the historian there, Emily Rankin, suggested that I may want to look into the history of Kennett. And I did, and every time I mentioned it to somebody, they got excited.
Mm-hmm.
Their eyes lit up.
Sure.
They just thought it was the greatest thing.
Yeah.
And everybody seemed to have a story, or they seemed to know about Kennett. And their enthusiasm was very infectious to me, and it kind of kept me going. It was very hard to find information, and I wasn't... I took Jane Schulberg's book, The Copper Cities, which was essentially the book about her family, the Golinski family.
Oh.
And I got some background information from that, but it wasn't until Ron Joliffe and the Shasta Historical Society published the Copper Cities book that really gave me the reference material I needed to finish my documentary, and then from the documentary, I wrote the book. So I was really thankful that it all, he put it all together, so it was very easy to understand what mines were there, what areas were in this Copper Crescent, because there was a lot besides Bully Hill and Copper City, Corum and Keswick, and so that was very helpful to me in writing the book.
So do you know of any other settlements that the lake has consumed when it rose? Was Corum underwater?
I don't know exactly. Yeah. And I don't know many of the other towns other than Copper City. And there was a map back in the early 1900s that showed where the mines were at, sure. And then kind of showed where that Copper Crescent kind of followed along the Sacramento River and then turned onto the Pitt River.
Yeah. Well, so it became a boom town again.
Yes, yes. And these people, I thought also what was very interesting is as they're building the dam, they discover gold. And so then people got all excited thinking, the place the lot that we bought to build a house, there might be gold on it.
But you only got a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
Exactly,
something.
Yes. So they built the dam, but there was one individual who was such a diehard Kennett resident that even after they built the dam and the water started to collect, he got a boat. A houseboat, and he put it right above where his house would have been. And yes, it was just, it's amazing the stories and the things that you come across. Yeah. It's like, oh my gosh. So can you imagine?
So got a boat out there. What was his plan?
He was just, because he felt that he wanted to live. That was his home. So he put his houseboat up there, and he put his boat, and went back and forth, and I know that's really diehard.
It's almost sad.
Well, in a way, yes, it is.
So, tell me a little bit about films. Now, you're involved in films.
Yes,
historical.
Yes, yes. I think it's very fascinating to take a topic and start with nothing and make something out of it to create. And I like to tell the story. And in this, the book is one story, but the documentary also has additional footage, clips that try and, again, paint a picture of what it was like to live there and who the people were and what kind of things were going on.
Well, it looks like we're getting close to time here. Kennett, The Town Underwater, if somebody wants to get their hands on that book, I'm sure there's plenty of people who will. How do they do that?
Well, I sell it on my website, and it's www.myrabuteaufilms.com, or you can order it from Amazon, or I have it in the gift shop at the Shasta Dam Visitor Center, the gift shop in the Boomtown Museum, and the gift shop at the Shasta Historical Society.
Okay. Why don't you mention that website again?
It's www.myrabuteaufilms.com.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for coming in. It's been fascinating.
Oh, thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
It's a great book, folks. So we're going to wrap up here. You've been listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our show tonight, my interview with Myra Buteau and talking about her book, Kennett, The Town Under Shasta Lake. And please remember that Giving Tuesday is next week. We could sure use a donation. See, our equipment here at KKRN, some of it's getting old and really does need to be replaced if we're going to continue bringing you quality broadcasting, the shows you like. So Giving Tuesday, please remember us here at KKRN and make a donation. Thank you.